We'll open it to the floor. If you could, why don't we group the questions at first, take some four or five and see how many rounds that we can have. And if you could indicate your affiliation, that would be terrific. Yes.
My name is David Kane. I'm with the Maryland Marine Law Office. My question is also for Mr. Craig. In 2003, the former president of Bolivia, as well as Mr. Lozada, fled his country, also called Jones. He fled his country shortly after a massacre in which 67 people were killed and more than 400 were injured. And he sent another meeting to every case in Maryland about 10 minutes from trying to avoid any sort of legality three or I understand that you are currently serving as Goni's lawyer in the civil trials, civil cases that have been brought against him. And I'm wondering, in light of your talk today, improving relations with Latin America, what you're feeling towards the extradition order. The Bolivian government recently sent an extradition order to the U.S., which will be shortly turned over to the State Department. And if you are advisor for Obama's future presidency, for example, would you recommend that
and if you would, if you could try to keep your questions short, because there is a lot of interest. Richard?
Richard Feinberg, great panel. To get our minds around a major readjustment of assets that's occurred in the hemisphere in the last 10 years, whereas we in the United States have been running huge deficits, there's not going to be a lot of new money for foreign assistance programs, for example. The Latin American countries as a group have accumulated over $500 billion in foreign exchange reserves as a result of much improved macro policies as well as the global economy. My question would be, in addressing this long agenda that people have tried to point out, what should the U.S. do to engage with, cooperate with, incentivize the Latin Americans, particularly the South Americans, to use at least a little portion of this large accumulation of reserves for hemispheric priorities?
Kevin, back.
Another question for Mark. The same figure you said that since quantum polymer was initiated, actually the percentage of cocaine coming from South America from Colombia has increased. In other words, more dependent, if you want to put it that way, on Colombian cocaine and on Bolivian cocaine. Is that trend true? If it is, what are the policy implications, either real policy or what has to be done?
Okay, one more on this round now.
Yes, my name is Betty Brannon. I'm a reporter with Avanza of Panama. My question is also for Mr. Craig. It's reported that you are representing Fedomeo Gonzalez, who is a fugitive from American justice, accused of murdering a U.S. soldier. What is your view of that case, and do you feel that it prevents you from being a member of Senator Obama's team, since the Dallas Morning News editorialized that you should choose between the two?
Should we maybe start with a question for Mark or do it in the same order that we went?
Okay, can I do it from here?
Yes.
Okay. Richard, I'm going to start with your question. I think it's a great question. I think it's, in fact, provides a great opportunity. And it goes back to what we said earlier, both Greg and I, and also Nora and Mark, which is that if you have a new administration, you would hope that they would begin by consulting with instead of dictating to. And in that context, it seems to me that you're in the best position to consult with them about how those resources, a portion of them, can be used to deal with the issues of income disparity that we saw in the issue of poverty reduction. And I say this because there is an area where I think that there's a common thread over the last several years about what's been lacking. There's been a fundamental lack of investment in rural areas of the region, in rural infrastructure. And when you go back and you look at Beyond the Cities by the World Bank, the report, it focuses on the impact of failing to invest in rural infrastructure on national economic growth in the region and on reducing national poverty rates. And my assumption would be that that would be an area that would perhaps not be at all confrontational or confrontational with respect to particularly countries like Bolivia and Ecuador and Venezuela. And so that you would have a common vision, and Mexico, that is, you have a common vision of an area of need and a way to use those resources in an effective way. And I would argue that you go back to the New Deal and you go back to what the U.S. did in rural America in the 30s. Build rural bridges, rural farm-to-market roads, get electricity into the rural areas, make investments in rural schools, rural health clinics, and begin to incorporate them. You begin to deal with both the underlying problems in terms of equity and the problems in terms of political instability. Kevin, in terms of the failed drug policy, unfortunately, there's been an increase both in the flow of the coke cultivation and cocaine production in all three of the countries between 2005-2007. The reality is that, as I said earlier, it's a failure of the supply side policies, but even more importantly, demand reduction policies. On the supply side, the failure is to focus on eradication. In the case of Colombia, aerial eradication. All it does is it moves it around. And so in 1999, there were 9 departments in Colombia where cocaine was found to grow. Today, there are 23 departments. And people move. They go back. They go into, if you talk about environment, they go into the national parks because they think it's less likely to get sprayed there. And so what you've got is you've got a policy which targets the most vulnerable part and the least valuable part of the cocaine food chain, which is the small campesino who grows it. And that's actually where most of the money goes in terms of supply reduction. Instead of putting the money into rural development, rural poverty reduction as your major area, and then strengthening the full range of rule of law institutions and target them on the higher end of the drug trafficking chain. That's not there.
It is true that we represent Sanchez de Lozada in connection with the incidents of September and October 2003 that resulted in his departure from the country. We do not accept your characterization of those events as a massacre. And we could have a debate with you as to what the facts are as we see them. But we would take the position and we just file a motion to dismiss the Alien Tort Claims Act case that was filed in, against the Minister of Defense and has been filed also against Sanchez de Lozada in the federal courts. We take the position, and I think it's supported by the facts, that what happened there did not involve crimes against humanity, did not involve genocide, did not involve disappearances or torture. It involved, tragically, civil disturbances which caused lives. But the circumstances surrounding that are not tantamount to genocide or crimes against humanity. And on grounds of, I'm not aware that there has been yet a extradition request filed by the government of Bolivia to the government of the United States, but we would argue if that extradition request is in fact filed, that it doesn't meet the fundamental requirement of dual criminality, that what happened in Bolivia, while tragic and by any measure, sad at the loss of life, involves a loss of life as a result of an armed effort to overthrow the government, a democratically elected government. It resulted from attacks by armed demonstrators on police and military people trying to resupply the city of La Paz that had been besieged for a number of days, or to rescue tourists who had been in Toronto and had been cut off on their return. So I think, with respect, we have a fundamental disagreement as to whether the words that you use, massacre, genocide, crimes against humanity, really apply to those incidents. On the question of Pedro Miguel Gonzalez, it is true that I've been advising Mr. Gonzalez in connection with discussions that he is having through his attorneys with the Justice Department about the outstanding case. I have not undertaken to represent him in any other proceedings other than to open up a path of communications between him and the Justice Department about that case. When it comes to my role in the Obama campaign,
The campaign knows full well of my involvement with this, and I have withdrawn from any participation in discussions with the candidate or any of his advisors dealing with U.S. Panamanian patients.
No, I just wanted to respond to Richard's question. I think that, nice to see you. I think that, first of all, the reserves, I wouldn't use them for putting together any kind of cohesion fund, which is, I may use that word, because I think their insurance that the countries hold should times get to be a little iffier, and they might. So the countries want to have their own ways to deal with the macroeconomic policy without having to resort back to the IMF as they had to do in the past. That's what reserves, that's the role reserves are playing. Having said that, I think, you know, what you have one country which is engaging very heavily in trying to help the poor in other places, but I guess the U.S. will not want to support it, but I don't know, maybe next administration will, which is Venezuela. And I don't know whether that's the route we want to encourage. I would rather see a hemispheric, including the U.S. I mean, the U.S., even if it has a high deficit, is still the richest country in the region, put together something that could be workable through investment funds, cohesion funds, that the European Union use to try to bring the backward countries and the backward regions within the countries with resources from the richer countries, with resources from the countries themselves, and try to invest to close the gaps through investments in infrastructure, education, etc. I think that that would be more, I think, the route that one has to pursue, and hopefully as the U.S. withdraws from Iraq, as everybody seems to be promising on the democratic side, there's going to be savings, which can be maybe put to other objectives, including this one, which could generate a much better neighborhood in the hemisphere that could help the other problems that have been pointed out today, in the drug issue and the migration issue, etc. So that's, you know, what I would suggest.
Ready for another round?
Yes. I would like to hear a little bit more about the immigration, Bush immigration policy in light of possible U.S. recession impact on immigration, and just to hear a little bit more about what the viewpoints are on immigration policy.
Yes.
This is Ben Bishi, and I work with Witness for Peace, which analyzes the impact of U.S. policy towards Latin America. My question is regards to the agricultural chapters of the NAFTA-style free trade agreements that we've been seeing, both in NAFTA itself and in more current agreements, such as the one we consider with Colombia. One of the popular criticisms, and I think there's a fair amount of evidence that this is true, is that within NAFTA, the agricultural chapters led to the displacement of a number of farmers within Mexico, which has actually exacerbated one of the U.S.'s own concerns, which is migration coming from Mexico. Estimates range from 1.5 to 2 million corn farmers being displaced since 1994. In Colombia, there's estimates, projections that a similar phenomenon would take place with the displacement of corn and wheat farmers in Colombia. This would actually exacerbate yet another U.S. concern, which is drug production in the region, since most of those likely to be displaced live in coca-producing areas of the country, particularly Cauca, and in park-controlled areas of the country. So given the ties between likely displacement created by the agricultural chapters of these free trade agreements with migration and with drug production in Colombia, what do you actually foresee a realistic change in this particular agricultural chapters of free trade agreements in the future? Nora, you mentioned the renegotiation of existing agreements, and also to Craig, to Mr. Craig, and you're not speaking directly on behalf of Mr. Obama today, but if you could, as a member of Obama's campaign, comment on what the plans might be under an Obama presidency.
No.
In the back.
Jennifer Stewart from the Center for International Policy. I was wondering if the panel could comment on the extent to which the presidential candidates, the next president, whoever may be elected, whoever he or she may be, what extent they could or would implement the policy that you recommended today.
Just in general, it seems that the Pentagon is playing a very, very strong role in U.S. Latin America policy. Would you care to comment on that? I mean,
Pentagon.
Yeah, on migration, I think that what's going to happen is that the demand for migrants in the U.S. is going to fall, particularly with the construction industry going down, etc. A lot of jobs will not be there. So one would expect some of the flow to be kind of slower in the future, and people having to go back because they're not going to find employment here. So the issue is more how are you going to deal with the impact on those families that were dependent on the remittances that will not be there or will not be there as much. And here is where I think that there's going to have to be some forms of targeted safety nets that do not exist now and are not funded in the current budgets in Latin America that will deal with this problem. For the future, I think that you do want to have sort of an orderly agreement on migration that will allow forms of migration coming to the U.S. without being constantly demonized and, you know, guest workers programs, etc. But we don't have time to go into detail. As for the agricultural change, by the way, I didn't use the word renegotiate because that makes everybody nervous. I think you have to think of a system by which you have an agreement which is static. Most of these agreements, you know, they're cast in stone, and, you know, anything that you want to talk about becomes very threatening. Maybe, you know, turn them into sort of more alive agreements in which you have some format under which you can go back and look what isn't working because the conditions in the countries change or the preconditions were there. In the case of agriculture, Mexico, I think, lost the opportunity to really do all the things that it had to do within the country so that the dislocation wouldn't occur. It didn't do it. So you do have this dislocation, and it's a problem, so things might have to be revisited as a result of the current situation, although we have to wait and see what the current food prices are going to be like in the future. But what I would suggest is having this umbrella under which you can go and revisit. Let's not use the word renegotiate, because that would mean that you have to go back and get approvals, and etc., and that creates a stumbling block, and nobody will accept it. You have to find a middle way for this.
Good?
However you want to do it, Mark.
Let me start with on the question of the agriculture chapter. It seems the NAFTA did have a differences in terms of the time period in terms of when it was applied. Now, this last January is when most fully affected the agriculture. I think those are issues of concern. I think there's real issue of concern of what the impact is on the, particularly the remaining ejidos and the small farmer in terms of the impact of particularly of U.S. Food crops, food exports. And here again, I think the answer has to be quickly analyze what this likely impact is and come up together with a combined response. And that actually goes as well as my concern about the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. I continue to ask the question, what's the impact on rural poverty in Colombia, particularly of those areas that are where they have adopted alternative development and are growing other crops other than coca? And I'd like somebody to tell me what the impact is. And not necessarily to change the elements of the agreement, but to have a parallel program, if it turns out those are losers in the mix, to have a parallel program that provides them with some kind of support. And I have yet to see that, and that does cause me some concern. Pentagon. I think that this is an issue of concern. The Pentagon, to some degree, this goes to the question of how they've responded in Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly in Afghanistan, where the lack of civilian agencies because of security issues, to carry out the development issues, concerns, the Pentagon creates something called provincial reconstruction teams, in which they embedded some civilian agencies, but basically it's run by the military. And they like it so much that they've now proposed to create an African command, whose function essentially is security seen, but with a much broader focus across the reconstruction and development framework, in which the Pentagon would actually be, again, the lead agency in carrying out activities. There's now something called, used to be 1206, which permits them to fund activities in this area. 1207, now this year 1210 money, they transfer the money to the State Department and or USAID to carry out activities. And my concerns are what the rules are. In the case of Colombia, there's a program going on in META, a pilot program. It's called Integrated CCAI. But it's basically an integrated rural community development program designed to bring resources into a community after you get security. And so not just police, but also development investment. That's fine, in my view. The problem is it should be run by civilian agencies, not by the military, and the transfer of funds, if it does occur, has to be done so that the transfer of management responsibility is full and complete. So it's no longer the military running the program, even if they provide the money to somebody to do it. I prefer the money went directly to civilian agencies, USAID. And I suppose I would argue to a new Democratic administration that that's what they should do. That there needs to be more civilian capacity and reconstruction in areas like Colombia to do essentially integrated development, and then civilian agencies need to be in charge. I don't think the Pentagon views itself initially as the agency that has a comparative advantage in helping develop education institutions, health institutions, rural microcredit. I mean, it's not their job. They shouldn't be doing it. We need to figure out how to ensure that civilian agencies have the resources to do it and are available.
Let me just answer your question first. That was the last question, as to what extent you think the candidates would incorporate what we recommended into their policies. All I can tell you in response to that question is that the people in this room that are engaged in the political process, which includes Mark, includes Mr. Feinberg, includes Janice O'Connell, includes a number of people that have been very active as advocates and as decision makers, as policy makers for a long period of time, will be included in, I think, in any Democratic administration as participants in trying to change our direction in Latin America. No one can say with certainty how that administration will go ultimately, but I can tell you that the people that will be making those recommendations are the people that you've been hearing today and are in this room today. Secondly, on immigration policy, I think we discovered two things in our last and rather sad chapter of experience with trying to reform our immigration system, that it's going to be very hard to do it piecemeal. You have to do it comprehensively. That's the first lesson. And the second lesson is that you can't do it with one party alone. I think you have to have both parties. So your ideal immigration reform is probably not going to survive. Neither will mine. It will be some kind of compromise to try to get some kind of meaningful change. And whether that means that there's going to be some kind of a wall left, it's probably likely that that will happen. Finally, to respond to the Witness for Peace question, which I thought was a very, very good question and sort of sensitized me to this issue that I had not fully been aware of. It struck me as you asked that question that we now have some symmetry and displacement. That, and my sort of instinctive response was exactly what we heard from Nora, which is we need better safety nets, not only in the United States for workers that are displaced because of jobs that are lost, but for people equally displaced and in trouble as a result of the impact of whatever the provisions are, and we have to keep our eye on that, or else we're gonna fail our populations, because we can't maintain this increased immigration without also having a sustaining political constituency behind it. And so it's not a question of whether, it's a question of how we do it, in my judgment.
This has been absolutely fabulous, and I want to first thank...
Let me just say, I can't speak for the Obama administration.
But we all will know their telephone numbers, and hopefully they all will answer our calls.
Again, I want to thank Aaron Wooden Schwartz, who did a great deal to bring this all together. He's the assistant to the program. And I especially want to thank Greg Craig, Mark Schneider, and Laura Lustig for these really thoughtful recommendations. And we are, I think we leave inspired. So thanks for inviting me.